5. Where is your brother? Outside, it's blue-black and getting darker. There is a man walking up the steps. He is unshaven and is wearing sandals and a poncho made from, one can be almost sure, hemp. I do not want to talk to this man. I have talked to the man from the California Public Interest Research Group. I have donated to the couple from the women's shelter, and to that little boy from the youth group, to the woman from the Green Party, the kids from the boys' club, the pair of solemn teenagers from Sane Freeze. The Berkeleyness of Berkeley, so charming at first, is getting old. The bell rings. You get it, I say. I'm not here. You're right next to it. So?
So?
Topher. He gets up, sock-footed. I am given a look. Tell them you're home alone, I say. You're an orphan. He opens the door and says something to the man, and suddenly the man is in our living room? What did I just say? Oh, the babysitter, Stephen. Stephen is a grad student at Berkeley, from England or Scotland or Ireland. He is quiet, bores Toph to tears, and rides a bicycle with a huge wicker basket attached to the front. Beth found him at school. He had posted a flyer. Hey, I say.
Hello,
he says. He brings his bicycle into the living room. I go to my room to change. I come out, tell him that I'll be back by midnight. Actually, can you stay until 1?
I don't see why not.
Good, then let's say 1.
Fine.
But I might be early.
Okay, then.
Depends on what happens. And I tell him that Toph should be in bed by 11. This is our third time with Stephen, who is replacing Nicole, who we liked a great deal. Toph liking her almost as much as I was hoping to like her, but who graduated a few months ago and had the temerity to move away. There was also Janie, the Berkeley student who insisted on having Toph come to her Telegraph Avenue apartment, and who was fine until one night after she and Toph had been playing soccer in her hallway with a balloon. He usually came home drenched with sweat. She had joked,
"You know, Toph, you're fun to hang out with. We should go out sometime, get a few beers."
Thus, Stephen. I kiss Toph on the head, which is covered by a baseball hat, worn backward. The hat smells like urine.
Your hat smells like urine, I say.
It does not, Toph says. It does. It does.
How could it smell like urine?
Maybe you peed on it? He sighs, takes my hands off his shoulders.
I didn't pee on it.
Maybe by accident?
Shut up.
Don't tell me to shut up. I told you that.
Sorry.
Stephen, I ask, will you smell this hat and tell me if it smells like urine? Stephen does not think the question is a serious one. He smiles nervously, but does not make a move to smell the hat. Well then, I say, we'll see you later. Toph, well, I guess we'll see you tomorrow.
Then out the door, down the steps, and into the car, and as I'm backing out of the driveway, there is the usual euphoria, free, which pretty much overtakes me. Often I laugh out loud, giggle, bang the steering wheel a few times, grinning, put the right tape in the stereo. This time it lasts for 10-12 seconds.
Then, at the moment that I am turning the corner, I become convinced in a flash of pure truth-seeing. It happens every time I leave him anywhere that Toph will be killed. Of course, the babysitter was acting peculiar, was too quiet, too unassuming. His eyes had plans. Of course, so obvious from the beginning. I ignored the signals. Toph had told me Stephen was weird, repeatedly had mentioned his scary laugh, the veggie food he brought and cooked, and I just shrugged it all off. If something happens, it'll be my fault. He will try bad things on Toph. He will try to molest Toph. While Toph is sleeping, he will do something with wax and rope. The possibilities snap through my head like pedophilia flashcards, handcuffs, floorboards, clown suits, leather, videotape, duct tape, knives, bathtubs, refrigerators. Toph will never wake up. I should turn around. This is stupid. We don't need this kind of risk. I don't need to do this. Don't need to go out. It's silly, juvenile, inconsequential. I need to go back. But I have to do this. There is no risk.
But there is risk. But the risk is worth it. I'm so, so evil.
I open the window, turn up the volume. I pass 2 cars at once and get on the highway and speed toward the Bay Bridge, doing 70 in the left lane, along the water. Through the toll, the light, onto the ramp, onto the bridge. Now I can't turn back. The Oakland shipyards to the left, a billboard encouraging the saving of water. I will come home, and the door will be open, wide. The babysitter will be gone, and there will be silence. And at once, I will know. There will be the smell of everything being perfectly wrong. At the steps up to Tove's room, there will be blood. Blood on the walls, handprints soaked in blood. A note to me from Stephen, taunting. Maybe a videotape of everything. I will be to blame. His little body, bent, blue. The babysitter was standing there, and he had already known what he would do. As they stood there, I felt something wrong, knew something was off. I knew it was wrong, and still I left? What does that say? What kind of monster? Everyone will know. I will know. I will not fight. There will be a hearing, a trial, a show trial.
How did you come to meet this man, this babysitter?
We found a posting on a bulletin board.
And how long did your interview of him take?
10-20 minutes.
And that was enough?
Yes, I guess so.
You didn't really know anything about this man, did you?
I know he was Scottish, or English.
Or Irish.
Could have been.
And you left your brother to go where?
Out. To bars.
To bars. And what was at these bars?
Friends, people, beer.
Beer.
There was a special, I think.
A special?
On the beer. Certain kinds. Oh, you know, I just wanted to be out. I didn't care much what we did. You have to understand that at that point I was getting out once a week, tops. Maybe once every 10 days. And so when I could get a babysitter on a night when anything was happening, I threw myself at it. Would leave early so I could be out for a while. Would have the babysitter come at 6, 7, whatever. And I'd race into the city to eat with whoever was eating. Maybe they'd just be sitting around at Moody's, usually, watching cable, getting ready, and I would be there on the couch with a beer from the fridge, savoring every minute, not knowing when it would come again, and they would be casual, having no idea what it meant to me, even when I'd be a little manic about it all, a little overeager, laughing too much, drinking too quickly, getting another from the fridge, no problem, okay, hoping for something to happen, hoping we'd go somewhere good, anything to make the night count, make it worth it, justify the constant red-black worry, the visions. I felt so detached sometimes, went for weeks at a time without really being around people my age, like living in a country where no one understands your words.
Over the bridge, the cross-cutting wind floods in. I turn the volume up. Far to the left, down and half a mile south, tankers float in the Black Bay, waiting to touch Oakland. Is it bravery to stay, or bravery to go?
A betrayal. There will already be ambulances there. There will be lights. The neighborhood will pop and glow like a carnival. But quiet. Just the lights, the whispering. Everyone asking where I am. Where are the boy's parents?
They what? Well, where is the boy's brother? He what?
To the right, there is Treasure Island, then Alcatraz, then the inlet, the ocean. Through the tunnel, we are spaceships, the cars changing lanes, hungry, searching, shooting through the barrel, quick and lateral like water bugs. And after the tunnel, there is the city, the thousands of light-bright tubes stuck through the night's paper black. There will be a small casket. I'll be at the service, but everyone will know. They'll try me and convict me, and I'll be killed in a chair, or hanged. I'll be hanged because I'll want the pain, slow, the veins burning, bursting. Oh, but that embarrassing erection at the end. In the brown light of the cavernous bar, Brent is still trying to name his band. At the moment, they're called The Gods Hate Kansas, after a 60s science fiction novel, but that name has been held for almost 6 months, and it's time for moving on. He is straw-polling the alternatives, which he has scribbled on a long, thin piece of paper, like a little scroll. Scott Beowulf, Van Gogh Doggo, John and Pontius Pilate, Jerry Lewis Farrakhan, Pat Buchanatar, Kaja Gugu Bunatorial Process, Spike Lee Major, Tom Dick, and Harry Connick Jr. Mints. Most of the names are like this, the melding of two or more cultural elements, ideally one high and one low, the smugly clever, utterly meaningless result. There are other, mostly local, bands that have planted their flag in this territory. JFKFC, Thomas Jefferson Slave Apartments, Prince Charles Nelson Reilly. Brent and I and everyone else are standing on the bar's second level, looking down upon the heads of the 100 or so below us, while drinking beer that has been brewed on the premises. We know that the beer has been brewed on the premises because, right there, behind the bar, are three huge copper vats with tubes coming out of them. That is how beer is made. Everyone is here. Brent, Moody, Jessica, Casey, Pete, Eric, Flag, John. All these people from high school, from before high school, from grade school, earlier. All from Chicago, all just out of school, all living out here. It's the manifestation of an inexplicable sort of mass migration. About 15 of us out here, with more of us landing in San Francisco every month, all for different reasons, for no particular reason. Certainly no one has come to take advantage of this job market, which is anything but enticing. For now, we're all scraping by with temping, with anything. Jessica is nannying in Santa Rosa. KC teaches sixth grade at a Catholic girls' school. Eric's in grad school at Stanford. And Pete is part of some dubious Jesuit volunteer corps. Cult is living with a half dozen other conscripts in Sacramento, where he works for the Prisoners' Rights Union, editing a popular periodical called The California Prisoner. The presence of all these people is both surreal and immeasurably comforting. They constitute the only ties Toph and I still have to home, because already, less than a year since we left Chicago, we have lost touch with each and every one of our parents' friends, even our mother's friends. Which was odd, Beth and I felt. We expected our progress to be more closely followed, to be checked up on. But it's just as well. Those conversations and epistolary exchanges, when they happened early on, were always awkward, fraught, their worry for us palpable, poorly hidden, their distrust, we thought, implicit. These people, though, these friends, they create for us and for Toph a willy-nilly world of faux cousins, aunts, uncles. They eat with us, do the beach with us. The girls, Casey and Jessica, buy kitchen implements for us, come over to casually straighten up, make beds, clear the dishes from the sink and the bedrooms, are available at any time for questions regarding the boiling of corn, the unthawing of frozen beef, and all have known Toph since he was born, held him when he was bald, and so do not question his presence at movies, barbecues, at any social gathering. And he knows them, too, can discern their voices on the phone, their cars in the driveway, remembers most of the words to our high school talent show act, the one we all rehearsed in the basement for months. At that point, Toph was maybe 4 or 5 years old, but he was there every time, would beg our mother to stay for every minute, watching us from the stairs, giggling wildly. He knew every word. And so I try to entice these people out to Berkeley as often as possible, want them around, as much for my own amusement as for continuity, to step in as extended family, to play roles. The aunt who cooks, the aunt who sings, the uncle who can do the trick where he puts the stack of quarters on his bent elbow and catches them in his palm, a snap of the arm. And they do come out, stay out, as much by choice as not. Moody, for one, is over all the time. Lately has been sleeping on the couch at least 3 nights a week. We have been close since high school when we shared foot odor powder, compared acne remedies. We were both abused by it. And drank Miller Genuine Draft in his basement bedroom supra pad. Picking up from our highly successful high school fake ID business, we were the first in town to utilize the then-new Macintosh technology, obliterating the competition, though still using Polaroids and poster board. And from my back room, we've begun a tiny graphic design operation, complete with laser-printed letterhead and raised shiny ink business cards, $39.99 for $500, catering to clients, much like our fake ID patrons, who want things done quickly, cheaply, and don't mind so much if they're riddled with errors and... Thank you. John has gotten me a beer. John is broken, and I've known him forever. He's got a nice tan, as usual. He always liked to be tan. He grew up in the neighborhood, and our parents were close. I've known him since I knew anyone. There are pictures of us under the kitchen table eating popsicles, of me in their backyard drinking out of the bird feeder with a straw. Together, at 9, 10 years old, we would painstakingly write letters to the makers of Lego, suggesting design improvements and offering ideas for future products. Enfield, Connecticut is where the Lego headquarters sit, I still remember. And I was as much his parents' child as he was ours, and even in junior high and on, when we had less and less to say to each other, we were still inextricably tied. We're stuck with each other. Our closets full of the other's borrowed clothes. His parents are gone, too. His mother, tall, blonde, loud, had done cancer our second year in high school, a huge mess, bringing him even more snugly into our family. 5 years later, after a year at Penn, He transferred to Illinois to be closer to his father, who was not doing well and had a stroke, had been treated for depression. And a year later, he went too. An aneurysm, such a fucking mess we were. It was only a few months after my own father, that whole year cloudy for both of us. We didn't even see each other that much. It just made it worse, the sight of each other reminding us only of what we had in common and the wondering if we needed to ask how the other was doing, but ending only in mumbling, hands over mouths, nervous sniffing. After his dad's funeral, John had missed only a few days of school, was back on Wednesday.
"You're back," I said.
"Yeah,"
he said. He had nowhere else to go.
"What's with the knuckles?"
"They were cut, scabbed."
"Oh, I broke a window, you know."
I said I did know.
Did I know?
"And now he's out here, living in Oakland for now. After graduating, he tried Chicago first, but tired of constantly running into people from Champaign. They were all there, the whole school. So few make it out of the state. To most, Chicago was Oz. Anything beyond it was China, the moon."
"So, how's tough?"
he says.
"Fine,"
I say.
"Pliers, handcuffs."
"Where is he?"
he asks.
"Paint thinner, Vaseline."
"He's home.
Babysitter."
"Other stuff? Stuff he brought from Scotland?"
"Oh."
I change the subject.
"How's the job search going?"
"I don't know. Good, maybe. I just saw a job counselor."
"A what?"
"A job counselor."
"What does that mean?"
"He's a guy who helps you figure out, okay, I know, but how does it work exactly?
You talk to him about your interests, he gives you a test, like a multiple choice test."
"Yeah, it took about 3 hours.
He gives you a test to find out what kind of job you want?"
"Right."
"You're kidding."
"Why would I be kidding?"
We watch the crowd below. They are wearing clothes they bought secondhand in the mission, or for twice the price, in the hate. They have unbuttoned the first two buttons of their tight, synthetic fibered shirts, worn over t-shirts with logos for non-existent companies. They have shaved heads or carefully messy Westerberg hair. They are young men up from Stanford in light blue Oxfords with short-shorn, shiny heads, hard with gel. There are small women in big shoes with snug, ribbed shirts.
Everyone is talking.
People have come with friends and are talking with the friends they've come with. They're out with people from work. They are looking into the faces they see every day and are saying things they've said 100 times. Like us, they have in their hands beer that has been brewed on the premises.
"Should we order some food?"
they say.
"I don't know, should we?"
they say. From here, the bar's second floor. Their mouths are moving, but their words are only groans. One continuous monotonal groan, a sort of mooing, punctuated by the occasional squeal.
"Oh my God!"
There's too many of them.
Of us?
Too many.
Too similar. What are they all doing here?
All this standing, sitting, talking. There isn't even a pool table, darts, anything. Just this loitering, lolling, this drinking of beer in thick glasses.
I've risked everything for this?
Something needs to happen. Something huge. The taking over of something. A building, a city, a country. We should all be armed and taking over small countries. Or rioting, or no, an orgy. There should be an orgy. All these people. We should close the doors and dim the lights and be naked together. We could start with all of us, Casey and Jessica. Go from there. That would make it all worthwhile. That would justify everything. We could move the tables, bring in some couches, mattresses, pillows, towels, stuffed animals. But this is obscene. How dare we be standing around talking about nothing, not running in one huge mass of people, running at something, something huge, knocking it over? Why do we all bother coming out, gathering here in numbers like this, without starting fires, tearing things down? How dare we not lock the doors and replace the white bulbs with red and commence with the massive orgy? The joyous mingling of 1,000 arms, legs, breasts. We are wasting this.
What could we possibly be talking about?
Pete sidles up.
"Hey there,"
he says, with a trace of the British accent he cultivated in high school.
"Tell me," he says, "how is young Toph?"
Fine, I say.
Where is he, anyway?
I love Pete, and he means no harm, but why this question? Why this question twice in one night? Much like the "what a good brother" refrain, "where is your brother" has become a sort of required question, but with no internal logic. Why ask me when I am out trying to drink and incite orgies where my brother is? What answer could Pete, could John be expecting? A ridiculous question. How would be fine. How is your brother? Makes sense and can be answered easily. Toph is fine. But why? Where?
At home, I say.
Oh, with who?
Razors, chainsaws, freezers.
I have to go.
I plow my way to the bathroom.
These questions, these people should know better. Are all my friends morons?
In the bathroom, someone is peeing in the sink. As I am noticing that there is someone peeing in the sink, that someone notices me noticing and naturally thinks I was looking at his penis, which I was not, which was sitting there on the sink like a newborn chick, purple and wrinkled, reaching for water. I want to leave, but immediately realize that would make me look even more suspicious, as if I entered the bathroom specifically to see the man's penis on top of the porcelain sink, and having done that,
yes, I see,
I was free to leave. I get a stall, close the door behind me, and there, at eye level, is one of our stickers. Screw those idiots. Might Magazine. Moody and I designed them a month ago, passed them out to friends with instructions to put them in bathrooms, on walls, lampposts, cars. It was to be the first step of a 3-month preliminary marketing campaign, getting everyone's tongues wagging with the word might.
What is might? They will ask, intrigued. I do not know, but when it becomes clear what it is that they will be doing, I will be interested in their doings.
There was not much of a debate involved in deciding what the stickers should say. It was obvious, and as far as we were concerned, it said it all. Screw those idiots. But now, looking at the sticker, crookedly slapped on the cinder block wall, I realize there's a problem. It's unclear who is being screwed.
Who are the idiots that should be getting screwed?
Oh, fuck. Sure, we intended it to be fairly vague, the idiots interpretable as anyone, other magazines, employers, parents, hippies, the corner grocer. But now, a terrible question rears its head. Are we implying that the sticker's reader should be screwing us?
Oh, God. It does. It does.
After all, just after it implores the reader to screw those idiots, it says Might Magazine. We're the ones to screw. It offers no choice. It's a disaster. We've covered the city with stickers telling people to screw us. There are so many ways it could have been better phrased. For instance, Might Magazine says, screw those idiots. Or, screw those idiots, says Might Magazine. Or, screw those idiots. Those idiots not referring to those behind Might Magazine, the makers of this sticker, who are good people and should not be screwed.
This is terrible. This is Armageddon. We've already printed 500 of these things.
I lean over the toilet and try to peel this one off. I'll remove every one by hand. But it only shreds, feebly. I pick and pick with no discernible progress, my fingernails black with gobs of sticker matter. My shins are wet from toilet bowl moisture, and I'm still hanging through my zipper. When I leave the stall, the purple chick penis man is gone, and when I get back to our spot by the railing, half of the people are gone. Jenna is standing alone. We chat idly for a good 2 or 3 minutes before.
So how's your little brother?
Fine, thanks.
I am worrying, but there's no way.
What's his name again?
Toph.
That she would ever...
Where is he?
She asks. Jesus. These people.
I look down at the crowd, all the dumb people down there.
Toph?
Oh, I haven't seen him in weeks.
What do you mean?
I mean, he's probably somewhere in the Dakotas about now.
What?
Yeah, it's fucked up. He just took off one day, hitchhiking, around the country with some friends.
You're kidding.
I wish.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, don't worry. It's partly my fault, I guess. He was a little pissed at me, I guess. Typical adolescent stuff.
What do you mean?
I have been looking down, watching a middle-aged man in a beret and black leather jacket mingle with 2 college-aged women. The poor man, not knowing that it's all over for him. Forever, beret and all. I glance over at Moody to make sure he isn't hearing us. He'd kill me. He's not paying attention, so I look at Jenna, both for dramatic effect and also to make sure she's still with me. She is, so I continue. I am not sure why I continue. People ask questions, and before I can formulate a truth-oriented answer, I lie. I lie about how my parents died. You remember that embassy bombing, the one in Tunisia? About how old I am? I always say 41. How old Toph is, how tall he is. When they ask about him, they get the most elaborate lies. He just lost an arm. He's got the brain of an infant, a half-wit, a badger. I only use that one in his presence. That he's in the Merchant Marine, he's in jail, and Juvie is back out, selling crack. Oh, give him some crack, and you should see his face light up. That he's playing in the CBA. Well, he got into some trouble at school, I tell Jenna.
What kind of trouble?
Well, you know how you're not supposed to bring guns to school?
Right.
Well, I had told him not to bring his gun to school. Simple as that. Everyone knows that. You can play with it in the house, in the neighborhood, whatever, I told him, but not at school because rules are rules, right?
Wait, he has a gun?
Of course. Sure.
How old is he?
9. Almost 10.
Huh. So, they caught him with the gun?
Oh, it was much worse than that. See, Toph has a sort of temper, you know, and so this kid, Jason somebody, had been bugging him, singing some annoying song all day, some song Toph didn't like at all, and finally he just snapped. Whack! Just like that, he takes the gun from his locker and squeezes one into him.
Oh my God!
Yeah, I know. No, I tell her, little Jason isn't dead, he's fine now, pulled out of his coma a week ago. And then naturally I took away Toph's gun privileges and, of course, beat him within an inch of his life, so zealously that something snapped in his leg somewhere, a tendon maybe, and he fell to the floor, squealed like a pig, couldn't get up, had to be taken to the emergency room, that while we were at the hospital some doctor must have snitched or something because a cop shows up and...
What did you tell the cop about his leg?
Jenna wants to know. Oh, that was easy. I told her he and a friend were whipping each other with wet towels.
And she believed you?
Of course. Of course. You wouldn't believe what people will believe once they know our story. They're ready for anything, basically. Will believe anything because they've been thrown off balance, are still wondering if any of this is true, our story in general, but aren't sure and are terrified of offending us.
Yeah,
she says, not getting it. I decide to wrap it up. Anyway, then he's on crutches for 3 weeks, really resenting me and everything, really holding a grudge, and then, boom, the second he's off the crutches, he's gone.
Hitchhiking.
Right.
I'm so sorry. Listen, if there's anything I can do...
One thing?
What?
Don't tell Moody about this.
Okay. He'll worry.
He's gotta kill me. I better leave. She'll tell him and then he'll kill me. He'll punch me. He'll punch me like he did in high school after homecoming, at the lake, when I was drunk and fell on him from a tree. He'll hit me like he hit me then, one good shot in the sternum, sending a quick, simple message. You're an asshole. That I felt for months, every time I breathed. I find my car and drive across town, all the passing headlights glaring, mocking. That was probably bad, what I just did to Jenna. A therapist would say that was bad. Up 9th, across Market, up Franklin, and down to Cal Hollow, where Therese lives. Down the hill and over a few blocks, and her turreted third-floor apartment comes into view. Therese lives in the top floor of a huge light-blue house on Gough, a few blocks up from Union Street, in an apartment she decorated with her mother, complete with potholders and curtains and about 100 overstuffed pillows. The plan is for me to end up in her bed. Her bed is huge and has posts. I pull up across the street, which is set on a 45-degree angle, and look up for a light in her window. It's dark. There's that little plastic owl in her fire escape. She is asleep. No, a faint light near the kitchen. A TV? She could be up. She could have gone out and come home and could be up. It's only 11:30. Oh, to be inside. No. This is stupid. I drive around the block. I have no excuse to be there. I turn and go back. I will think of something. I park in the driveway behind her car and jump up the wooden steps of her porch and ring the bell. I will say I want to sleep there. I will say that I need to sleep there, that I was locked out of my house. This is so embarrassing, I will say, chuckling. One of those weird things, I will say. Was close by, was in the city when I realized. Tofs at Beth's, I'll say. Sorry. How are you? Were you asleep? She'll let me in. We'll go to the beach, like we did that other time, the last time I showed up at midnight, needy. When I asked her to come to the beach, she had been in her pajamas, but had gotten excited about going, had gotten dressed, and while she got dressed, I packed a bag full of bananas, Fig Newtons, and a bottle of wine. She brought blankets, and when we got in the car, dark, seats cold, we turned on the heat, squeezed each other's hands, and sped over the Golden Gate and through the headlands, the black road winding through purple hills like driving around the contours of huge, sleeping bodies. Past the old rickety wooden military buildings, the gun turrets high over the Pacific, and to the beach at Fort Cronkite. We parked by the darkened barracks and got out and took off our shoes and walked over that little pond on the gray wooden bridge. So loud. And the ocean was black. The wind was coming straight off the water. We huddled under the blanket, still barefoot, warming our hands in each other's armpits. She is not answering her bell. She will shake her head when she sees me, but she will let me in. I push the bell twice more. I turn around and face the street. A car, black, shiny, comes up the hill and stops at the corner. Inside is a woman, maybe 35, dressed up and driving alone. She sets the brake and fumbles for something in her purse. I am no more than 20 feet away. She will look up my way. She will look up at the porch and see me. She will open the passenger door and tell me to come with her and share her bed. I was hoping you'd ask, I will say, kind of suave-like. I will not care what we do. Anything would be fine. Nothing is okay, too. It does not matter. A bed with room and warmth and her legs entwined with mine underneath. I will comment on how cold her toes are, and she will rub them against my legs. Things like that often happened to people all over the world. The woman finds what she wants in her purse, relaxes the brake, drives up the hill, and turns. Therese is not home. I leave. At Union Street, the bars have just let out, and there are people everywhere. Julie bartends at a bar called the Blue Light, which, besides being imbued with just that, is full of mirrors and people wearing loafers and white pants. Julie I met at Moody's last party. I will drop in on her. I will pretend I'm looking for someone there, or else I'll be forward and tell her I just came to see her, because suddenly I was thinking of her and wanted to see her. She will like that. She'll be surprised and flattered. She might say it. I am both surprised and flattered. I park 5 blocks down. Union Street is bustling with people in white pants and loafers. People from Marin, New York, Europe. At the door, the bouncer will not let me in. I've left my driver's license in the car.
Need ID?
I know, but
sorry. Go away.
I just turn around and walk away. Of course I picture killing him. For some reason with a huge two-handed sword. Just lopping off his bald melon of a head. Listen, just... Is Julie here?
No.
Did she leave?
Didn't work tonight.
I walk back toward the car, past a few dozen more people in white pants, a few loners in khakis. Oh, if only something would happen. Nothing ever happens. This is all some terrible machine where only the expected passes through. I go to the White Hen pantry to use the payphone. I'll call Meredith. Meredith will come out. She answers. I ask her what is up. She says that nothing is up. I ask her what she is doing. She says that she is doing nothing. I ask her if she wants to do something. She says, okay. Meredith and I have never been more than friends, and since college, when she's been in L.A. and I've been here, we talk only on the phone. She's up visiting for a week, is staying just off Haight. I pick her up. We walk down to Nikki's. It's small, full of bodies, sweltering. Should we be dancing? I have to drink more, she says. And after drinking at the bar, pounding like in a prom limo, we dance. Clumsily, bumping into other people, sweating profusely, immediately. The crowd is tight on the small floor, and we are forced to dance close. Looking for space, we edge toward one corner under a speaker. It's deafening, whatever it is. Earth, wind, and fire? The bass is massive, invasive. The bass knocks loudly and then just pushes like floodwater into our brains and then is everywhere, forcing out all thinking. It brings 10 suitcases and sets up in the master bedroom. It rearranges the furniture. The bass vibrates through our heads, adding a soundtrack to synapses, to everything stored there, to remembered phone numbers and childhood memories. We let our bodies get closer, and of course the only place to look is down, where Meredith's body is gyrating, her parts becoming bigger, smaller. We leave the bar. We'll go to the ocean. The drive to the ocean is long. By now, the babysitter's done with whatever he wanted, has left on his basketed bike in his back at his hideout, telling his friends about it. They're having a good laugh. He is showing them the Polaroids. No, Toph would find a way. He'd pretend to be asleep or dead, and then, after Stephen fell asleep, after gorging himself on everything in the fridge, he'd come up behind him and bash him with something. His bat. That one we just got, the metal one. He'd bust Stephen's head in with the bat, and when I get home, he'll be a hero, tired and bruised, but a hero and happy, and he will not blame me for leaving, will understand. Me. Whew, that was close. He. I'll say. Me. You hungry? He. Now you're talking. Meredith and I park and take off our shoes. The sand is cold. As we walk toward the water, bonfires burn up and down the beach. Close to the waves, glowing from the headlights behind us, we sit down on a small towel and sit, lean into each other. But something has happened to our momentum. We were about to fall into the guiltless pleasure-taking that we had worked hard for earlier, that seemed inevitable only 20 minutes ago, but now we are here and it suddenly feels forced, silly between us, friends who should know better. And so we talk about our jobs. At the moment, she's working in post-production for the television reprise of Flipper. Really? I say. I did not know this. It's better than it sounds, she says. But she wants to be making movies, wants to have a whole studio, wants to be producing more and better movies, weird stuff, have a kind of collective, something like Warhol's Factory, all these people around. But you know, she's saying, it could take 5-10 years to get anything like that together. And it'll cost so much money. I mean, even if I started right now, it's the waiting that's the killer. The waiting to be wherever you plan to be. The groping through the days, the temping or post-production on Flipper. Everything takes forever. Right. To know exactly what you want to be doing, to know exactly what you'd make, given the means, given some time, all the projects lined up, the body of work, have it all mapped out. Who will be involved, what the office will look like, where the desks will go, couches, hot tub. It should be easier. It should be automatic, instantaneous. Every day, a world-clearing sort of revolution, a bloodless one, one more interested in regeneration than any sort of destruction. Every day we start with a fresh world, or better yet, each day we start with this world, the one we know, and by 9-10 a.m., we've destroyed it. I just contradicted myself. So, okay, there would be a certain amount of destruction, but it wouldn't be at anyone's expense or against anyone's will. Right. And let's say that every day, every morning, millions of people, on cue, take the whole stupid thing apart. All the cities and towns with hammers and saws and rocks and bulldozers and tanks, whatever. Shake the Etch-a-Sketch. We just converge on the buildings like ants, then wire the things and knock them down, knock everything down, every day so the world, by noon or so, is flat again, wiped clean of buildings and bridges and towers. I have dreams like this, where we move things. Yeah, and after the taking apart, when the canvas is blank, then we start over. But not start over in the Rome wasn't built in a day sort of way, not even in the rebuilding Germany sort of way. I mean, we wake up, tear the world down to its foundations, or below that even, and then by 3 in the afternoon, we've got a new world. By 3? Yeah, 2 or 3, depending on whether it was winter or summer. We'd have to have enough daylight to enjoy it. I mean, I think we could do something there. Like, imagine if 100 million people or more, way more. I mean, worldwide, there's got to be 2 billion people like us, right? So you take all these people and you spread the word that from now on, every day, we create everything from scratch. You mean like a more just and equal? Yeah, sure, more justice and everything. But as much as that, all the political and economic reasons to do it, I mean, beyond that, really, is the feeling of,
I mean, imagine walking among the ruins, you know? Wouldn't that be phenomenal? Not ruins like dead people everywhere or anything. I mean, just ruins, like things disassembled, cleared away, so every day you'd be left with just a bare, pure landscape. You'd have to have lots of trucks and trains to haul it away up to Canada or something, and every day you'd start from scratch and everyone get together and say, hey, let's put some buildings there, and, over there, let's have a 500-foot stuffed hippo, and there, in front of that mountain, a huge fucking, something else. Sure, sure. But you'd have to be able to accelerate everything, have everything be a bit easier than it currently is in terms of construction and everything. You need, like, huge robots or something. Sure, robots, of course. I'm dead serious about all this. I am, too. I'm with you. We can do this. Sure. We have to get people interested. Everyone we know. Even the flakes. John. Right? Good luck. I know. You know what he was talking about tonight?
You saw him?
Yeah.
I owe him a call.
He was talking about how he had just taken some test, an aptitude test, to tell him what kind of job he should have so he could be told what to do with his life.
Jesus. It's brutal. We need to change him. Inspire him. Him, everyone. Get everyone together. All these people. No more waiting. Means through mass.
It's criminal to pause. To wallow. To complain. We have to be happy. To not be happy would be difficult. We would have to try to not be happy. We have an obligation. We've had advantages. We have a platform from which to risk. A cushion to fall back on. This is abundance. A luxury of place and time. Something rare and wonderful. It's almost historically unprecedented. We must do extraordinary things. We have to. It would be obscene not to. We will take what we've been given and unite people. And we'll try not to sound so irritating.
Right. From now on.
I tell her how funny it is that we're talking about all this because, as it so happens, I'm already working to change all this. I'm currently in the middle of putting together something that will address all these issues, that will inspire millions to greatness, that with some high school friends, Moody and two others, Flag and Marnie, we're putting together something that will smash all these misconceptions about us, how it'll help all of us throw off the shackles of our supposed obligations, our fruitless career tracks, how we will force, at least urge, millions to live more exceptional lives, to, standing up for effect, do extraordinary things, to travel the world, to help people and start things and end things and build things. And how will you do this?
She wants to know.
A political party? A march? A revolution? A coup?
A magazine.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I say, looking out to the ocean, basking in its applause. It's gonna be huge. We'll have a big house somewhere or a loft, and there'll be an art gallery and maybe a dorm,
like the factory.
Yeah, but without the drugs, the cross-dressers.
Right, a collective, a movement, an army. All-inclusive, raceless, genderless, youth, strength, potential, rebirth, oceans, fire, sex.
Our mouths are all over each other, all the talk of plans and new worlds. We sit upright as we kiss, and at first we kiss like friends, with our eyes open, almost laughing. But as our hands start moving, we begin to believe, and our eyes close, and our heads turn this way and that. We're kissing each other, but so much more. Kissing like warriors, saving the world. At the end of the movie, the last two, the only two who can save everything. And because we are too post-drunk tired to keep our heads upright with our eyes shut, we recline, and soon the towel underneath Meredith is just a crooked snakeskin, and we've taken off our pants, the air cool where we are now bare, and sex, inevitable, will make us more powerful. A manifesto consummated under this great sky, the approval of the pounding sea. There's noise down the shore. I squint and can see a group of people coming our way, loud, emitting bursts of noise, shrieks of laughter. I set myself on my elbow to watch, squinting harder. A group of maybe six, seven are fully dressed with dark pants, shoes, hats. We move the towel from under Meredith's head to over our naked lower halves. We will act casual. We fall back into an embrace so they'll leave us alone. Not that they would ever bother us in the first place. The voices get louder and closer.
Just wait until they go by,
I whisper into Meredith's lips.
How far away?
Shh.
then louder, and the scratching footsteps audible, and then, instead of passing by, they are suddenly upon us, legs everywhere. I look up. One is taking my pants and is rifling through them. He throws them toward the ocean. Because I'm stupid, I assume they're from Mexico. Mexican-American. Teenagers. 4 boys and 3 girls. 5 boys, 2 girls. Men, women, ages unclear.
What was you two doing?
A voice asks.
Naughty, naughty,
says another.
Where's your pants, stud?
Only female voices so far, strong accents. Naked from the waist down, we can't even move. I hold the towel around both of us, disbelieving. What is this? This is the beginning of something very bad. The end? I look for my boxer shorts. They're in the pants, by the water. I take the other towel, the one underneath us, pull it out, wrap it around my waist, and stand up.
What the fuck are you Fuck!
Someone's thrown sand into my eyes. My eyes are full of sand. I blink, wildly, epileptically. I stagger, then sit down.
What the fuck?
The sand is under my eyelids. I can't open them. I'll be blind. The girls are on Meredith.
Hey, honey. Hey, baby.
Fuck you, says Meredith. She is still sitting down, head in her knees. One of the girls shoves her. I am blind. I blink frantically, swatting the sand out of my eyes, while wondering if I am blind and if we'll both be dead soon. What a stupid way to go. Is this how people die? Can we outrun them? I refuse to have these people kill us. Do they have weapons? No weapons yet. Toph, Toph. Blinking, tearing madly, I clear one eye out. I stand up again, get the towel back on, holding it around my waist like I've just gotten out of the shower. They are all around us, almost perfectly spaced, almost perfectly boy, girl, boy. Strange. One of the girls has come behind me and is trying to take the towel from my waist. It's unclear what they want. I'm assuming already that the guy who went through my pants took my wallet. Now what? Get the fuck away! I want to swing at the girl. I scan the ground for my boxers. What the fuck do you want?
We don't want nothing,
says a male voice.
Hey, you got any money?
Says a girl. You're not taking any of our fucking money, I say. Who are these people? One is smiling at me, a small guy with a fedora. I'm pushed from behind, trip on the towel, and fall to the sand. Meredith is holding her knees. They've done something with her pants, too. They stand behind us, grinning. There are laughs. There are 6 of them. Did one leave? Is Meredith crying? 3 guys, 3 girls. The lights from the headlights behind them give everyone 3, 4 shadows. Where did the other one go? There's the one tall guy, a medium-sized guy, and a small guy, the fedora guy, who looks older. The girls wear skirts and black leather jackets.
Why don't you just leave us the fuck alone? Says Meredith.
The question loiters for a minute, lamely. Stupid question. This has just begun, surely.
Okay, let's go,
says the short one. They start to, Jesus, walk away? All we had to do was ask? This is unbelievable. The short one, the oldest of the group, turns to us.
Hey, listen, man. We were just goofing around. Sorry.
Then he jogs down the shore to catch up with the rest of them. It's over. They are gone, and I am soaring. Those motherfuckers! My head is clear and muscular and filled with blood. Something has happened. We're alive. We've won. Powerful us. They were scared. We scared them off. They feared us. We won. We told them to go away, and they did. I am the president. I am the Olympics. I find my boxers in the sand, cold, put them on, then my pants. Meredith is putting on hers. I feel my pockets.
Fuck. Your wallet?
Yeah. They're walking back the way they came, 100 yards away now. I am barefoot and running feels good. My legs feel strong, light. My head is clear and straight. Are they armed?
Toph. Toph.
Will it get worse now?
No, no, I am huge. I am Captain America.
Halfway there, I start yelling.
Hey!
Nothing. They are oblivious, disbelieving even.
Hey! Wait, goddammit!
A few stop and turn around.
Hold on,
I say. They all stop. They wait, watching me run toward them. 20 feet before them, I stop. hands on my waist, breathing hard. Okay, who took my wallet?
Abid. They look at each other.
No one took your wallet,
the fedora one says. He looks about 30. He turns to his friends.
Did anyone take his wallet?
They shake their heads. These fucking people. Listen, I say.
What the fuck did you think you were doing? There's gonna be hell to pay if we don't fix this shit up.
No one says anything. I nod to the short, older one.
Should I be talking to you about this? Are you the man?
The words come before I know them. Are you the man? I just said that. It sounded so good. That's how people talk.
But should I have dropped the R in the question?
You the man? He nods. He is, apparently, the man. I motion for us to take a few steps aside to talk. Come here. He complies. This is what one does. He is shorter close up. I look down to him, his face stiff and tan.
Listen, man, I don't know why you guys were fucking with us, but now my fucking wallet's gone.
We didn't take the wallet, amigo, he says.
Did he just say amigo? That's so weird, so 21 Jump Street, that he'd actually say amigo?
Listen, I continue, I've seen all of you. I can identify you, every single one of you guys, and you'll be in deep fucking shit if you're caught. He considers this for a second. My eyes burrow. I am the man.
So, what do you want?
I want you to give me the fucking wallet back is what I want.
But we don't have the wallet.
The tall one hears him.
We didn't take the fucking wallet.
Well, I say to all of them now, loudly, before you came and started fucking with us, I had a fucking wallet. Then you come and start fucking with us, and now I don't have a fucking wallet. And that's all the fucking cops need to know.
The cops. My cops. The short one looks at me.
Come on, we don't have a wallet. I swear, what do you want us to do?
I guess you guys are gonna have to come back and help me find the thing, because if you don't, I'm gonna call the cops, and the fucking cops will pick you all up, and they'll figure out where the fucking wallet went.
The small one looks at me from under the brim of his hat, and then turns to his friends.
Come on,
he says. And then they are following me. We walk back, me walking to the side to prevent any funny business, ambushes, to the spot where we had been. Meredith is standing, dressed, and with a towel in hand. She doesn't know what to make of this.
They're back? All right. You better start looking. I hope you find it.
I pause as one of the girls throws me a disgusted look. Because otherwise, you're fucked. They spread out and start looking, pushing sand around with their feet. I stand to the side where I can see all of them at once, my hands on my waist, overseeing. I am the foreman. I am the boss. They lift and shake the towel we were lying on. Each one does it at least twice, the shaking of that towel. They shuffle around, picking up sticks, throwing them toward the water.
Fuck this, says one of the girls. We don't have the fucking thing. We didn't do nothing.
Fuck, you didn't do anything. That was assault, idiot.
I mean, who do you think the cops are gonna believe? Two regular people sitting on the beach, or you people?
I mean, sorry, but that's the fucking truth. You guys will be fucked.
I am the cop, a friendly but stern cop. I am helping them. I assume one of them still has the thing, that they're just stalling. I have to figure out a way to scare them to get the thing back. Then I... Should I? I shouldn't say that.
Okay, sure. I mean, I don't know what your status is with green cards and everything, but this could get really fucking ugly, you guys.
There is no visible reaction. They keep searching. Meredith starts looking too, but I take her arm. Don't. Let them do it. One of the girls sits down, sullen.
I sure hope you guys find the fucking thing,
I say, thinking that it's best that I be talking the whole time. I decide to throw out my last ace. This was my goddamn dad's wallet you stole. I'm not sure how much to tell him, but because I want the wallet back at all costs. And my dad just died, I say. It's all I have of his. And it is. He had so few things, personal things, and we sold the clothes, the suits. The wallet was the one thing I kept, outside of a small box of papers, some business cards, paperweights from his office. They keep looking. I look at their pants pockets, scanning for bulges. I briefly wonder if they'll let me frisk them.
Listen, man,
the short one says. We didn't fucking take it. What do you want?
I know the answer. I want the wallet. And then I want them in jail. And I want them miserable. I want them, all seven of them, or five of them, all of them, to be wearing gray uniforms that itch and chafe them as they sleep fitfully on cots, their stupid heads full of regret, their cheeks wet with their weeping for forgiveness. Forgiveness not so much from their simple god or jailer, but from me. They will be sorry. Their tiny heads will implode with guilt and remorse. My dead father's beautiful, frayed, soft leather wallet. It's not here, he says. Then you guys better come with me, I say. We'll have to find a phone. You can tell the cops your side of the story, I'll tell mine, and we'll see what happens. But if you guys take off, you're fucked, because then they're gonna assume you took it. We look at each other. He starts walking toward the parking lot. His friends follow. Meredith grabs a second towel, shakes it out. We walk behind the three of them to keep track. Three total. I can take two of them. All three even. I am massive. I am America. No one talks. Our shadows, two each, crisscross and jump over the sand, the scratching of our feet. The lights from the houses above the beach are few. That weird windmill at the end of Golden Gate Park is straight ahead, black. When we get to the parking lot, what I thought was a phone, a box attached to a lamppost, is not a phone. We stand for a second under the glare. I look around, up at the houses across the great highway, all glass facing the ocean, looking for support. Maybe someone on a porch, or a jogger, a biker. There is no one awake. Okay, we'll have to walk across, I say. We'll cross the highway and walk up until we get to a phone. I'm still in charge. We're a team. I am their leader, their stern but fair warden. They seem to consent. I walk toward them, expecting them to turn and walk toward the highway. As I come among them, they don't move. I am suddenly between all three of them. Everything is new.
Fuck you,
says the tall one, swinging at my head. I have no time to move, but he misses. Another swing from behind. Nothing. Then a leg appears and the foot lands in my crotch. I fall to my knees. I stare at the cement, gum, oil stains. They run away, arms and legs like big spiders, laughing. How long do you stay on your knees in a situation like this?
Fuck you,
they say. Creative. The kick wasn't bad. I still have breath. Then I'm up. I'm up and running after them. I'm in the middle of the parking lot road, and I see them just off to the right, 50 yards ahead, getting into... There are...
What?
Fuck. Two cars in the middle of the street, ready, revving. How did they know? As I reach the middle of the street, the doors shut. The cars start toward me. The front car is an old convertible, dark green with a black top, huge hood. One of the girls from before is driving. Holy fucking shit. Like a getaway car. I stand in the middle of the street as they come toward me. I want to get the fucking license plates. They drive at me, slow at first, but then faster. I have them. License plates, suckers. License plates, fuckers. As they come toward me, I yell the numbers of their plates out loud, pointing at them with every digit, exaggerating the pointing to make sure they know what I'm doing, that I've got them. Got them! G-F-6-7-9-0! Beautiful. Beautiful, you fuckers. You dumb, stupid motherfuckers. They swerve around me, yelling, laughing, waving their little middle fingers at me. I am yelling, thrilled, high. Ha-ha, you fuckers. I got you, motherfuckers. They pass, then turn onto the highway, accelerate, are gone. I got the first car's plate, but not the second's. I run back to Meredith. A block away, we find a phone.
Wait, calm down. Where are you?
The operator says.
I don't know. The beach. What's wrong?
We were attacked, robbed.
By who?
Bunch of Mexican kids.
I tell her what the car looked like. I try to tell her the license plate number, but she says she can't take it, to tell it to the officer when he gets there, she says. I hang up.
G-H-6-O?
Fuck.
G-H-O-O? Fuck!
We sit down. I'm not hurt. I think about whether or not I'm hurt. I'm not. We sit on the cement wall of the path, and for a moment I fear they'll come back. Maybe there'll be guns, maybe to eliminate the witnesses, a drive-by.
No, no, they're gone. They're gone. Won't be back. I jump down from the wall. I can't sit. I'm wired. I pace in front of her. I got their plates, stupid assholes. The police car pulls up 2 minutes after. It looks huge. The engine roars. It's immaculate, shiny like an enormous toy. The officer steps out, and he is burly and mustached, and...
Is he?
It's after 2 a.m. He is wearing sunglasses. He introduces himself and asks us to get in the back of the car, and we do. It is a beautiful car. Clean, the black vinyl bright, perfect. I answer, yeah, we were just hanging out on the beach. Seven of them. Mexican. I'm sure of it. Their accents, their looks, completely. They spoke English, but with a Mexican accent. I try to think of what they looked like, who the older one looked like. Beretta. He looked like Robert Blake. They took my wallet. I don't know how much. Maybe $20. We were calling the police to straighten it out. Yeah, they came with me. I don't know why, because they said they didn't take it. But then they kicked me in the groin, groin being the more police report appropriate word for a crotch, and then they got in two cars and took off. A big, dark green convertible with a black top. Yeah, yeah, I had it down before. Fuck, it started with G, H, and there's a six in it, and a zero. I think it ended with zero. Is that enough? Can you go on that? The car is so clean. I love the car. A shotgun hangs at eye level in front of us. The computer next to the steering wheel glows blue. Beautiful thing. The radio fitzes and beeps. The officer listens and answers questions on the CB. He turns around.
Okay, it looks like we have some suspects. We've stopped a car just off the highway. We're going to have to go there so you can make a positive ID.
I look at Meredith. We have been in the car maybe 3 or 4 minutes. Is that possible? You already found the car? Is it the dark green convertible? I ask him, leaning into the front seat.
I'm not sure, but we better go.
We go. Meredith and I look out the window, bright-eyed and attentive, like tourists passing through a city on a Saturday night. We turn onto another highway, and suddenly there are lights everywhere. It looks like an accident. At least 4 police cars. 5. All parked, lights spinning, popping. There are cops on the street, walking back and forth, standing outside their cars, talking into CBs pulled through their windows. It's an event. Our car stops before an overpass. There is an old convertible parked about 20 yards ahead, light blue with a black top. That's not it, I say. The officer turns around.
Excuse me?
That's definitely not the car, I say. Theirs is green, dark green with a black top. I'm positive. He looks at me and turns back around and talks into his CB. After a minute, he turns back to us.
Okay, we're going to ask you to take a look at the people in the car just to make sure, he says.
That's definitely not the car, I say.
We have to do this, he says.
There are 4 cops standing by the blue convertible. One of them opens the front door and reaches in, helping out a handcuffed man. The man shimmies out of the car and stands up. He turns towards us, squints. He has long blonde hair, a goatee, is wearing a flannel shirt, army shorts, black boots. The spinning lights make him blue and then red and then flesh-colored again, then blue and then red again. He looks through our windshield and into our car.
Do you recognize him?
No, that's definitely not him. I'm positive they were Mexican. This is definitely not the right car.
Well, hold on there. We're going to have to look at all the passengers.
Why? The cop makes a signal with his hand to one of the officers outside. They bring out a young woman with dyed red hair, a miniskirt, and go-go boots. She stands next to the first man.
My God, those poor people, Meredith whispers.
No, no, I say to the cop. You've got to understand, these people were Mexican. You know, shorter, dark-haired. These people are white. They bring out 3 more, 2 more men and 1 other woman, until they are all standing there, shoulder to shoulder, lit up, tinted red and blue, squinting into our headlights. Maybe they're people we know? Meredith grabs my arm, sliding down in her seat. God, I hope they can't see us. I lean forward and tell the cop again, that's not them. He talks to his CB for a while and writes something on a clipboard. As he makes a U-turn to drive us back, the kids standing by the road are just getting their handcuffs taken off. The other cops are getting back into their cars. We duck. We drive back to the beach parking lot. Once there, the cop turns around and gives us his card. Cops have cards. We get out. I ask him about the likelihood of them finding the Mexican kids, or the wallet. It's pretty small odds, he says. It's a wallet, you know. It's a little thing. Here's an incident report card. That's your incident report number in case you have anything to report. Or if we need to call you, you'll need that as a reference. Then he's gone. Meredith wants to go home and sleep. Half of me wants to get back to my car and cruise for the green convertible, hunt them down, get some kind of weapon first, and then drive, hunt, do bad things to each and every one. But I need to go home and see what's happened to Toph, whether the babysitter's done what I fear he's done. We don't talk much on the drive back to the Hate, down the wide, barren avenues of the Richmond. At her friend's place, she gets out. We agree to see each other again before she goes back to L.A. Then I'm going home, past all the dumb kids at Hate and Masonic, sitting against the wall, smoking in their Rasta hats, playing with those sticks, flipping the stupid fucking stick around with the two other sticks, as if that could possibly be diverting for more than 20 or 30 seconds, just the stick up and down, back and forth, my God. And down Fell, onto 80, and toward the Bay Bridge. Motherfuckers. Stupid motherfuckers steal my dad's fucking wallet. The only fucking thing I have of his. That and some stationery, the paperweights, the business cards, a high school yearbook, some papers about him being in the army. Those fucking kids, those fuckers. I'll stake out the beach tomorrow. I will not forget. The clouds above are fat, moving slowly over the gray bridge like manatee ghosts. On the bridge, I begin to feel the leaden, downward pull of the alcohol in my system. I nod off and on. I slap myself for the sound and the shock. Awake! Turn up the radio. On the bridge, the lower tier, it's straight ahead and action-packed. It's a Battlestar Galactica runway. It's the circuitry inside a computer, an old rickety computer, a 2XL. I nod again. Awake! The bridge is a tunnel. On bridges, I think of the accident, the one I heard related 100 times. My mom driving her tiny powder blue Beetle somewhere in Massachusetts. Bill and Beth toddlers over a 2-lane bridge. A tire blows, she skids, swerves, across traffic and brakes halfway through the opposite guardrail, the car's front hanging over the edge, her seeing it all ending, Bill and Beth screaming, me in her womb. There are a few other cars. There's a car full of men in a shiny black BMW. The lights of the bridge make the car shinier, sleeker, faster seeming. We are all returning home to our adobe homes, our wooden homes. There is a family in a small blue... Good God, put that kid in a seatbelt. Stupid fuckers, take that fucking wallet. I'm alone and will never go out again. When will I get out again? It will be weeks from now. It will be never. I am lost. I'm in the bridge's dark corridor, the lower tier, riding under cars going the other way, to San Francisco. I'm heading back to Berkeley, to the flatlands, to our house, where there is no one, where it is just my bed, quiet. And Toph. Blood on the porch, the babysitter has taken him away, or the babysitter has left him bleeding as a warning. Markings on his face, numbers, astrological shit on his chest, clues to the culprit. All my fault. I will run away. They will be looking somewhere tropical, but will not guess that I went to Russia. I will go to Russia and will wander around Russia until I die. How could I have left? My parents never left us as children. They didn't go out. They stayed home, were ensconced at home in the family room, reliable. He on the couch, she on her chair. After the bridge accident, she was a mess when driving over water, near cliffs, on 2-lane highways. On our one trip to California, all of us under 10, we went to see the sequoias, all the way up that mountain, and she made it up, around and around, 2 lanes all the way, but could not make it down on the outside lane. There was no barrier, just the sheer drop, and Bill tried to calm her. Mom, just, I can't. And so she parked, waited until a trooper could come and drive the car down for us. She in the passenger seat, turning around to smile at us, embarrassed. I make it off the bridge, down the hill, toward the highway split, Oakland or Berkeley. I nod awake again, this time after veering toward the median divider. I slap myself again and again and again. I open the window, the Ashby exit. Good, good. Close, close. University. I am home free. Stephen did something. Maybe I should leave now. Go to the airport, assume the worst. I will turn around if I see the flashing lights. I will come from Solano Avenue, down the hill, so I can see if there are ambulances. And if so, I can turn around and go to the airport before they see me. The wallet is gone. My father has slipped further down the well. The wallet was the constant reminder. Every time I used it, it was always there in my pocket. Taken by stupid Mexican spiders, the fuckers. The only thing I had of his. The rugs are unraveling, the furniture splitting. I cannot be trusted with anything. Everything precarious, lost, broken, soaked. This is not the way things should be. Toph and I in our dingy little house, holes in the floor, everything decomposing, me losing things, letting a bunch of kids take our father's wallet, and Toph with the babysitter, this evil man. It'll be cold in Russia, but maybe not now. I can get a jacket at the airport. The Gilman exit. I will not crash. I will move in with friends. I will get over it. I will either move to Russia or I will get over it. I turn onto our street, Peralta, and there are no lights, no cops, no amusement park lights of ambulances and cops and fire engines. The door is closed. There is no blood on the steps. I walk up to the porch, and through the window I can see the babysitter's bike still parked against the fireplace. And then, as I approach the door, I can see Toph sprawled on the couch. Good, good. At least he's here. Though he might be dead. He could still be dead. The door is not locked. Maybe someone else has killed Toph and the babysitter. I hadn't thought of that, but of course. A burglar has come in, has taken what he pleased, and then poisoned both of them. Or else he was Stephen's accomplice. It was all a setup. I step inside, careful, fists clenched. I step toward Toph. I look for blood. None. Poisoned, maybe. Or beaten. Internal bleeding. I bring my face close to his. His breath is hot on my cheek.
Alive! Alive!
He could be dying, though, like the boy in that movie, Bruce Davison and Andy McDowell's son. How will I know? I will trust. Go to the hospital? No, no. He is good. He is fine. There is drool on the arm of the couch. Where's Stephen? That's it. Stephen is gone because he poisoned Toph. Toph is dying. Toph has an hour to live. There will be no point to take him to the hospital. The woman's voice from the poison hotline will crack. There's nothing, nothing you can do. And broken, hysterical, I will gather my faculties so I can wake him, so we can talk for our last hour together. Should I tell him? No, no, we will have fun. I will pull it off. Hey, little man.
What time is it?
1. He is not dead. He will live. Everything is normal. Normal, normal, normal. Good. Good. Normal. Normal. Fine. I walk into the kitchen, drop my keys, tick, in the bowl with the change. I peek into the bedroom. No Stephen. To the back bedroom. Open the door. There. Stephen is asleep on the bed. School papers spread out everywhere. I wake him up. He gathers his stuff.
He was talking in his sleep,
he says. Huh? What did he say?
Nothing, really. Just mumbling.
I write him a check. I open the front door for him. He gets on his bicycle and, still half asleep, rides away, awkward and jumpy like a butterfly. I lock the door after him. I go back to the living room where Toph is splayed as if boneless on the couch. He has brought a comforter from his room, which is now on the floor. His mouth is open and there is a dark, round pond of drool on his gray t-shirt. Hey. Hey. Help me out here. I'm gonna put you in bed. Put your arm around. He puts one arm around my neck and grabs it with the other, pulls his head toward me so I don't hit it on the doorframe.
Don't hit my head.
I won't. The molding cracks.
Ow!
Sorry.
Idiot.
I lay him on the bed, in his jeans and sweatshirt, and put his blanket over him. In the kitchen, I check the answering machine. I look in the fridge. I wonder briefly about people I could call. Who would be awake? Someone will want to come over. Who would be willing? I walk back to my bedroom, drop my change on the dresser. The wallet. On the dresser. It was here.